You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online, at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's Miro.com.
This podcast is sponsored by Cloud Optimizer.
As a business owner or IT manager, are your cloud investment costs going up and you don't know why? It's time for Cloud Optimizer. As you migrate your business to the cloud, what you're spending and why you're spending it can get a little hazy. But Cloud Optimizer clears up the mystery and puts the cloud to work for you. Cloud Optimizer starts by analyzing usage patterns, right-sizing resources, leveraging discounts you may not be aware of, implementing automation, and much more. And by reducing unnecessary expenses and maximizing performance, Cloud Optimizer guarantees you a savings of 5 times what you spend for their service. As you utilize cloud-based services more and more, you don't have to lose sight or control of your spend. You can stay agile, streamline your costs, and optimize your performance, plus save significant money with Cloud Optimizer.
Make the cloud work for you with Cloud Optimizer. Get a free assessment and find out how much you can save by going to cloudoptimizer.com. Go to cloudoptimizer.com for your free assessment. That's cloudoptimizer.com.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Human Rights Watch is an independent, nonprofit organization known for their accurate fact-finding, impartial reporting, and targeted advocacy. In partnership with local activists and human rights groups, they expose the truth in order to defend the rights of all and bring those responsible to justice. They rely on the support of informed, dedicated people, so visit hrw.org/kick to make a donation and support its vital work around the world. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar until 2019. hrw.org/kick. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Ever wary of monarchs and autocrats, America's founding fathers, in their infinite wisdom, created fixed presidential terms of 4 years to limit executive power and give voters regular opportunities to remove their leaders. Even so, Americans have often resorted to more drastic paths to disempower the chief executive. Indeed, the American presidency has seen it all, from rejecting a sitting president's renomination bid and undermining their authority in office, to the more drastic methods of impeachment and, most brutal of all, assassination. Now, at a time when many in Washington are calling for the impeachment of President Donald J. Trump, or even the use of the 25th Amendment to declare him mentally unfit to hold office, it's useful to revisit the colorful political history of the schemes, plots, maneuvers, and conspiracies that have attempted, successfully or not, to remove unwanted presidents. That's the subject of a new book by previous guest of the show, David Preece, called How to Get Rid of a President: History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives. In his previous book, The President's Book of Secrets, this former CIA analyst wrote about the president's daily brief and how the commanders-in-chief consume intelligence information as an example of presidents behaving well. But he says his new book, How to Get Rid of a President, is about presidents behaving badly. And today, David returns to the podcast to talk about why he's writing this book now and whether he thinks President Trump might be a candidate for removal from office. He discusses the various presidents who've died in office, both of natural and unnatural causes, including 2 presidents who some suspect might have actually been poisoned. He goes into the history of presidential assassinations, including why the assassination of Abraham Lincoln probably could have been prevented, and a bizarre conspiracy by a cabal of wealthy businessmen to remove President Franklin Roosevelt by force. Then he explains the 25th Amendment, which allows for the president's cabinet and Congress to declare a leader physically or mentally unfit to serve, as well as the two presidents who played instrumental roles in crafting it, and the closest we've ever come to using it. David walks me through the surprising history of presidential mental illness and why some of Richard Nixon's closest advisors questioned whether he was mentally stable. And speaking of Nixon, of course we talk about the process of presidential impeachment, including when presidential lies rise to the level of a high crime or misdemeanor, and whether he thinks Congress could realistically impeach President Trump. Plus, the man who served as the daily intelligence briefer to former FBI Director Robert Mueller weighs in on the Russia investigation, what might be going through the mind of the famously tight-lipped Mueller right now, and what we can expect as the investigation winds toward a conclusion in the coming weeks. All that and more coming up with David Preece in just a moment. David Preece has a Ph.D. in political science from Duke University and served at the CIA during the presidencies of Bill Clinton and George W. Bush as an intelligence officer, manager, and daily intelligence briefer, and at the State Department. He's the author of The President's Book of Secrets, The Untold Story of Intelligence Briefings to America's Presidents, and his latest book is How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, and Unfit Chief Executives. David, welcome back to the podcast.
It is a pleasure to be back. Thanks, Ben.
Well, boy, with a title like that, How to Get Rid of a President, I have to ask, have you gotten a visit from the Secret Service yet?
No, I think if the title were How to Get Rid of This President, it might go in that direction. But even then, this isn't a book about advocacy. It's not suggesting anything in particular, and it's certainly not suggesting one of the methods of removal, which is abhorrent in any situation, which is what sometimes comes to mind with that title, which is taking the president out by force.
Yeah, and this is an interesting choice for a follow-up book to The President's Book of Secrets. As someone who's spent his life in intelligence, at first glance, it might seem a little out of your wheelhouse. What interested you in how presidents are removed from office?
The first book that we talked about before, The President's Book of Secrets, was really a story about presidents behaving well, presidents receiving intelligence, using it to inform their decisions, and generally doing that the way that we would expect. This book really balances that. It's a look at presidents behaving badly, a look at presidents who have proven or who have been seen as unpopular, unable, or unfit, and then the methods that we have to remove them. So it really goes back to my roots before I worked at CIA for a few years. It goes back to my roots as a political scientist, getting to study the history of our political system and how it might apply, those lessons might apply to the present.
And now there's an obvious relevance to this book at a time when some in Congress, and depending on who you believe, perhaps even some in the Trump administration discussing impeachment and even the use of the 25th Amendment. Do you think that you would have chosen this subject if we had a different man in the White House right now?
It's hard to say. The topic was certainly underreported. That is, there's plenty of attention to elections and how we get a president into office. And there's a lot of good stuff out there about how presidents manage the job and how people manage the president. But I didn't see anybody who had pulled together all of the different methods that we have in our system and some things outside the system that are used anyway to eject a president. There are books on impeachment. There's a lot of discussion about things like impeachment and the 25th Amendment, as you note. But nobody had really pulled all these things together. So I think it was ripe for the writing, but there's no doubt that 2016 made it more important to get this out.
You begin by talking about some of the more conventional methods for removing a president from office. One of them is simply to do it the old-fashioned way and vote him out of office. How often have presidents failed to get a second term?
Well, we've had quite a few of them fail to get a second term, but for different reasons. Mm-hmm. One of them is the primary reason you mentioned. It's the reason that the founders thought presidents would leave office often, which is they get voted out. They get to the next election and people go to the ballot box and say, you're fired. And we've had 10 presidents who were on the ballot for a second term and then got voted out of office. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't even have to get to that, because another method is the president not getting a renomination for a second term. And although that hasn't happened in recent history, it used to happen a lot more often, where a president lost support from his own party and he was removed, mm-hmm. in a sense, by rejection from his own partisans.
What would be the last case of that? Was that Johnson?
Yeah, I tell the story of Lyndon Johnson as that, and that strikes some people as a bit odd, because Lyndon Johnson famously went on television and announced he would not be running for another term in 1968 because he wanted to focus his energies on winning the war in Vietnam. But looking at the history, what I noticed is Johnson, behind the scenes, was still doing all the things one would do if one were planning on jumping into the race at any moment. In fact, at the Chicago Convention of 1968, when the Democratic Party was splitting itself apart, Johnson was at his ranch in Florida, and he happened to have with him two speechwriters and an airplane fueled up and ready to fly to Chicago at a moment's notice. He thought the delegates would beg him to come in and rescue the party. The delegates wanted some sign from him first that he wouldn't just reject their overture. And what happened? It never clicked.
Interesting. So it was a little bit of a bluff on his part, huh? And he got called on.
Right on. Everything in his political character suggests that he really did want another term. And he was doing some of those things behind the scenes that one would do to be able to jump in, especially after Bobby Kennedy was assassinated and the Democratic Party didn't look so sure about how its nominee would play out in the election.
Mm-hmm. The second chapter deals with, I would say, one of the less democratic strategies for getting rid of a president, which is simply to undermine the president. As someone who's worked at CIA and respects the chain of command, I wonder, does it worry you when we hear these rumors of aides hiding papers from the president and Secretary Mattis and others disobeying what arguably are pretty crazy orders from President Trump?
It is understandable, but it is disturbing ethically. I wrote a piece on this recently on the Lawfare blog, laying out the ethical slippery slope that we get into when we normalize people assuming presidential powers for themselves. At looking at the history of this, it has happened. Sometimes subordinates do things like fail to follow through on orders from the president. Richard Nixon's chief of staff, H.R. Haldeman, was famous for this. He simply issued his own pocket vetoes to things so that they did not get enacted. Henry Kissinger did some of the same. And then in the last, 8 weeks or so, we've seen two different reports about this. One was anonymous, writing in the New York Times that he or she was part of a secret cabal undermining the president and resisting his worst impulses. And then we, of course, had Bob Woodward in Fear writing about people, in some cases, literally taking papers off of the president's desk that were there for signature so that he would not take a certain policy step. The problem with that is they weren't elected. The president was. And once you break the norm of the president being able to make policy and have it faithfully executed, that makes it harder for every president in the future who's going to rely on that norm.
Certainly, it sets a very dangerous precedent, regardless of what you think of Donald Trump. Another chapter deals with presidential deaths. How many presidents have died in office of natural causes, or at least, let's say, died by means other than assassination?
Yeah, we've had several. It started with William Henry Harrison, somebody that we really don't know much about today,
yeah.
In part
for good
because
reason.
He only was
right.
In office for 31 days.
Yeah.
I think that is probably why he's most famous, is because he's famous for not being famous. But we've had several others die in office, like Zachary Taylor, through what I would call natural means, Franklin Delano Roosevelt being the most recent. And then, of course, we've had some taken out by force. Either way, they're removed from office. They're removed from life. So they're also removed from office. Now, one strategy that can be used is if you have an older president who maybe isn't in the best health, opponents may decide they don't need to use any of these other methods. They can just wait it out and hope that he or she dies. That seemed to be a good strategy with William Henry Harrison, who was the oldest president elected at the time he came into office.
Yeah, and kind of the popular story with him is that he's known for two things. You know, the shortest term in office and giving the longest inaugural speech. And supposedly he gave this long inaugural speech in the middle of the pouring rain, and then he later succumbed to pneumonia. Is that too simplistic a read on what happened to Harrison?
It probably is, because, you know, most of our mothers told us if you don't wear a hat in the cold, windy weather, you're going to get sick. But sickness isn't caused by cold weather.
Right.
It probably was a germ, but he almost certainly was in a weakened condition. And it didn't help him that he had gone on for hours in that cold, windy day right after he was inaugurated. Mm-hmm.
And some have also called into question the sudden deaths of Zachary Taylor and Warren Harding later on, suggesting that they might have been poisoned. Have there been any forensic investigation into how these two died? And if so, what did they reveal?
For Zachary Taylor, who was president in the middle of the 18th century, there was some question about, was he a victim of, I think, arsenic poisoning?
Right.
And they went back and they did some tissue samples a few years ago, which is remarkable if you think about it, but the technology was good enough that it would have been able to detect the latent levels of arsenic that would have been necessary for that poison to be in his system. And they found it was not. They found that despite the theory, there was no evidence to back it up. With Warren Harding, he was a man who was extremely unhealthy anyway. But nevertheless, one author wrote that he thought that Harding's wife did him in because she was the last one with him. And he did have a habit of cheating on her a lot. And maybe she wasn't too happy with him and thought that he'd be better off dead. I did not find any firm evidence for that. In fact, the person who put that theory forward had some other credibility issues. So probably we have not had a poisoned president.
Okay. The most famous presidential assassination is, of course, easily that of Abraham Lincoln. And it's all the more tragic because it probably, I think, could have been prevented. It's not like it was the first attempt. They had fair warning. And you detail a number of the attempted assassinations that preceded Ford's Theater. Talk about some of those near misses.
That's right. Both with Lincoln and some of his predecessors, there were plots that came very close to removing presidents by force. One of the early ones was Andrew Jackson. And I didn't know the full story, but somebody walked right up to him at the Capitol building with two loaded pistols, and both of them failed to fire. But that's one that seemed like a more likely assassination than some of the ones that actually happened.
And he probably wished they hadn't tried that too, huh?
Yeah, Andrew Jackson was not someone who suffered insults lightly, and I would certainly think that he would interpret somebody shooting two guns at him as an insult. So he quickly took his cane and was proceeding to beat the person up when other people intervened. You didn't want to cross Andrew Jackson in person. Abraham Lincoln, a much nicer guy than Jackson, certainly, but he had assassination attempts on him even before he was inaugurated as president. One of the stories in the book is how Abraham Lincoln actually had to smuggle himself through Baltimore so that when he could get to his inauguration, he would not be killed along the way in a plot uncovered by a detective that was helping Lincoln.
Yeah, and I was surprised that the president with the most attempted assassinations or assassination threats was actually FDR. Was he really that hated, or was it simply that he was just the longest serving president, so there was more opportunity?
It's a function of both of those and one other thing. First, yes, he was in office for, he started his fourth term. He didn't get very far in it, but he was in office longer than any other president. He also brought out a lot of energy. Some of his programs, the New Deal in particular, were very controversial, and he brought out some of the haters. But the third factor is that FDR was president during some very trying times. The Great Depression was one. The Second World War was another, and both of these were challenging times. In fact, one of the stories I write about in the book is FDR and a possible attack on him when he was at a summit meeting with Winston Churchill and Joseph Stalin. A story would have changed history dramatically if those three leaders would have been taken out during one of their meetings.
Yeah, and you also bring up this supposed cabal of businessmen who plotted to kidnap FDR, and I guess they were going to reinstall him as their puppet or something like that. Was there any truth to that?
You know, it's a convoluted story, and there's a lot of different interpretations of it. Historians are mixed on whether this was an actual plot or not. Available evidence suggests that there was something going on, that there were some businessmen upset with what they saw as a turn towards socialism in the New Deal program, and they wanted to install at least a very right-wing government behind Roosevelt, and some said almost a Nazi sympathizer government instead of Franklin Roosevelt. It didn't get very far, and the investigations into it at the time did not lead to any prosecutions, so it's still up in the air how severe it was.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with David Preece when we come back in just a moment. In the next 60 seconds, you're going to learn how the Flatiron School can change your life. The Flatiron School will teach you everything you need to get a job in code, data science, or design. But they'll also prepare you for the jobs that don't even exist yet. Because this is a school designed to educate you in the art of change. So if you're feeling stuck, bored, or unfulfilled, Flatiron will teach you how to change things. You'll learn by making things, breaking things, and discovering how the future is being built. The results speak for themselves. Go to flatironschool.com/podcasts to read about graduates' new careers and salary ranges and explore upcoming courses as well as exciting new careers. You can start building your own new career in coding, data science, or digital design at one of Flatiron School's WeWork campuses or take courses online. Go to flatironschool.com/podcast and read about graduates' new careers, salary ranges, upcoming courses, and explore these exciting new careers. Enrollment is now open. It's time to future-proof your career and change things, starting with you. flatironschool.com/podcast. You also deal with what would happen if a president was unable to serve. Prior to Trump, I'd wager a guess that the average American didn't know a darn thing about the 25th Amendment, but suddenly it's been front and center in the national debate about President Trump. It provides means by which the president can either voluntarily transfer power to the vice president if he's unable to discharge his duties, but it also provides a means for removing the president involuntarily if his inner circle determines that he's incapacitated. It was only adopted in 1967, and indeed it might surprise listeners that it was actually two presidents who were instrumental in its passage. Talk about what Eisenhower and Johnson did to call for this change and what led them to call for
it. We'd had many cases before then of presidential disabilities, but the Constitution didn't provide a specific mechanism by which power could be transferred, so it never happened. The president just continued being president even when unable to perform the duties of the office. The main case in the book is the case of Woodrow Wilson, who was incapacitated by a stroke, but nobody did anything. They just carried on and hoped it wouldn't happen again. Dwight Eisenhower had three severe health crises during his presidency, and some of them took him out for many weeks. So he came to an arrangement with his vice president, Richard Nixon, by which Nixon could say, well, the president's not able to do his job, so I will temporarily take power. But that was a letter written between them, and it did not have the force and the power of the Constitution behind it. But that isn't what triggered the 25th Amendment. What actually triggered the 25th Amendment was the assassination of John F. Kennedy, because if that shot to the head had been slightly different, and Kennedy had gone into a coma instead of dying nearly instantly, what would have happened? People would have said, well, the vice president clearly needs to become president, but what's the mechanism for that? The 25th Amendment creates that mechanism by which the president can declare a temporary transfer of power and then take it back, or by which the president can be forcibly removed by the vice president agreeing with the majority of the cabinet or some other body that Congress designates.
And since then, several presidents have invoked Article 3, correct?
That's right. Ronald Reagan, when he had a surgery, and it's interesting, I talked to Fred Fielding for the book, who was the counsel for Ronald Reagan, and he said that Ronald Reagan specifically wanted to transfer power to the vice president when he was being put under for surgery, but he did not want to bind the hands of his successors to have to do that in all such cases. So he crafted a letter, which was bizarre, which said, I'm transferring power to the vice president, basically saying the same language as the 25th Amendment, but then saying, and I do not think this is an application of the 25th Amendment. He was very clearly trying to keep his example from becoming a required practice, But it did break the ice, and that's why George W. Bush had no problem transferring power temporarily to Dick Cheney a couple of times in his presidency when he was put under.
And even in the case of Reagan, it was still a little chaotic and convoluted because, I don't know if these are true, but the legend goes that there was kind of this power struggle where Al Haig, the Secretary of State, thought that he was in charge while President Reagan was under and supposedly might have almost launched a nuclear war. But
yeah, this is that case when Reagan had an assassination attempt against him and he was in the hospital. That is a case when the power should have been transferred to the vice president, but it was not. And the people involved now in retrospect often say, yeah, that's kind of what we have the 25th Amendment for, and we blew it. We did not invoke the 25th Amendment, and if something had happened, it would have been dicey because you did have a situation where the vice president was flying back from Texas. You had people at the White House not sure exactly who was in charge. The press conference announcing it was a debacle, and all of that could have gone even worse. Thankfully, Reagan later in his presidency said, yes, if I'm going to have surgery and I know I'm going to be unconscious, I will invoke the 25th Amendment myself.
And what's the closest that we've ever come to invoking Article 4 of the 25th Amendment or removing a president involuntarily?
We have not yet had what, Ben, I would call a close call. Okay. We haven't had a case where the papers were drafted and they were going to deliver them to the leaders of the Senate and the House to implement it and just held back. We haven't gotten there yet, and I think that's because it's a really difficult thing to do. Think about it. The vice president of the United States has to say, against the president's will, you are incapable of doing your job. Now, that is understandable if it is a coma. Let's say that the president is completely unconscious, cannot be woken up. Then it would be relatively easy and understandable for the vice president to invoke Section 4 of the 25th Amendment. Short of that, any time that the president may be showing erratic decision-making, maybe not acting in a normal way, any time the vice president would go in and say, sir, I think you're acting just weird enough that I'm going to take power from you, there's no way that can't look like a coup. And most vice presidents aren't willing to take that political hit to do it, even if they think there is some kind of a disability affecting the president.
And I suppose the closest that we ever came to that was Richard Nixon. And you talk about in the book how he was drinking heavily toward the end and would sometimes be paranoid and erratic the later it got into the day. How concerned were people about his mental state in those days?
Some people around him were very concerned, including family members, because he seemed at times unable to do what we would generally call the duties of the presidency. In one case, Henry Kissinger, the National Security Advisor and Secretary of State, had to take a letter from the Soviet leader during a Middle East crisis and respond to it in the president's name because they decided not to even wake up the president because he was probably drunk. Now, what they didn't do is invoke the 25th Amendment, even though it was applicable at the time. There's nothing on record that shows they were, again, going down Pennsylvania Avenue to deliver that letter that would invoke the amendment.
Interesting. And it doesn't just apply to Nixon. Mental incapacitation and particularly depression were pretty common among U.S. presidents. You cite a study that said that 25% of U.S. presidents may have suffered from some form of mental illness and often depression. That's a high number. Were the reasons for their depression unique to each president, or are there certain aspects of the job that make a person susceptible to it?
Oh, I think it's both. And you're right, that was a disturbing factoid that I found. And those were actual psychologists and doctors making that assessment by looking at the historical record, using available files to make the same kind of diagnosis that they would in the modern day. And sure enough, overwhelmingly, they said the majority of those 25% were victims of severe depression. And we had some of our presidents that are not as well known, like Franklin Pierce, who suffered from dramatic depression at a time while in office. But I also tell the story in the book of Abraham Lincoln, one of our better presidents, who suffered from crippling depression at various points in his life and even while in the White House due to the loss of his son and due to the events of the Civil War. The White House can be a dark and lonely place, but it can be even darker and lonelier when you've got something like a civil war and the death of your son. In Lincoln's case, however, instead of it debilitating him, somehow it drove him to greater heights. It drove some of that legendary compassion and empathy that Lincoln was able to channel that into. So not every case of a even perhaps a clinically diagnosed depression would need to be a case of transfer of power if they had had the 25th Amendment then.
And some in Congress, and as we discussed, perhaps even in the administration, have questioned Donald Trump's mental fitness to hold office. From what you've seen, is that a realistic option?
It is very difficult to imagine issues of judgment and issues of even radical policy being the basis for a declaration of disability. Number one, the people have voted, and the people knew they were voting for a mercurial president who had a different temperament than most of his predecessors. Mm-hmm. So there's that. People knew what they were getting into at the ballot box. Number two, the 25th Amendment, the declaration of a disability, was never meant to be a policy correction. It was meant to deal with a president who literally could not do the duties of the office. The only scenario I can imagine where something like that could happen is if the president starts issuing decrees that are literally gibberish, that make no sense. Not that they're bad policy, not that they go against decades of American internationalism or things like that, but things that, you know, start declaring chickens Secretary of State or something that is a clear indication of some kind of mental illness. We haven't seen that. Now, we don't know what's going on inside the corridors of the White House, but even some of the information that's come out through reporting doesn't seem to indicate that he has no grip on reality. He perceives reality perhaps different than all of his predecessors, and maybe he doesn't care as much about reality as he does about his gut instinct, but we haven't seen any reporting pointing to the fact that he has a defined, definitive, serious mental illness.
Now, the one that's being discussed a lot these days is the possibility of impeachment. This right. one's always been a bit of a mystery to me, because while the reasons for impeachment are fairly specifically limited to, I think, three possibilities, those possibilities tend to be vague. Even treason can be viewed rather vaguely, and certainly high crimes and misdemeanors is something that not a lot of people today are very familiar with, and it's hard to define. Walk us through the justification for impeachment.
Sure. The Constitution only gives those three reasons: treason, bribery, and the amorphous high crimes and misdemeanors. Treason at least is defined in the Constitution, and it makes it a very high bar for somebody trying to remove the president to do, because it requires a condition of aiding an enemy, meaning wartime, and something that seems archaic now, but it requires witnesses. And that's just a hard thing to imagine in most contexts. The second method, bribery, is a little more straightforward. If there's actual evidence of the president taking a bag of money for a particular policy, or possibly paying for somebody to do something, bribery can go both ways, that could be considered an impeachable offense. High crimes and misdemeanors, that's a little rougher, Ben, because it's not really well defined now, and it wasn't well defined then. What we know about it is what we've learned from what the founders did not put in the Constitution. They did not put in the word maladministration, which was considered basically good governance gone wrong, because they didn't want the Congress holding votes of no confidence on the president. They settled on high crimes and misdemeanors, which the best things we can figure out about that are, first of all, that they wanted to leave it flexible enough for future generations to apply it, so they did not simply name every possible crime and misdemeanor. We also know that the founding generation was not shy about amending the Constitution when they felt that it needed it. There were, I think, 13 amendments in the first 12 years or so after the founding of the country. If they thought high crimes and misdemeanors was so bad they really botched it, they would have had the opportunity, and they showed themselves willing to amend the Constitution, and they didn't. So they must have been happy enough with that flexibility that it provides.
Yeah, it's something of an archaic term. Where does that term high crimes and misdemeanors go back to?
Well, I looked at some of the legal scholarship on this, and I am not a legal scholar myself, but having looked at it and talked to some constitutional experts, it appears that it builds on some English law traditions. And in that sense, the word high, modifying crimes and misdemeanors, means matters of state. That is, you can have a crime or a misdemeanor when president, but that is not necessarily an impeachable offense if it does not affect the fabric of government. And this is the argument that was used in the Bill Clinton impeachment trial. He was impeached, that is, the House of Representatives voted to essentially indict him, But when the trial was held in the Senate, people said, okay, yes, he may have perjured himself. He may have tampered with witnesses. Those are bad. But it was not to undermine the institutions of the United States. He did that in order to protect a personal affair. And that did not seem to many people who were voting like the meaning of a high crime or misdemeanor.
And this is very relevant because we're dealing with a president who is famous for taking liberties with the truth. When do presidential lies rise to the level of high crime and misdemeanor? Does it have to be something that was done in office? Does it have to somehow relate to his position? For instance, covering up the Stormy Daniels affair, and if campaign funds were used to do that, or if there was an in-kind contribution, how does that all play into something like that?
There are two parts to that. One part is the legal part, and one part is the political part. On the legal part, we don't know. There is no settled application of this. In theory, if the House impeaches and they call something a high crime and misdemeanor, and the Senate removes for that article of impeachment, the president is gone. There is no appeal. But you could also imagine a scenario by which something that otherwise they would be loath to do, the Supreme Court could intervene. Let's say that the House of Representatives said, we don't like Donald Trump's hair, and we think his hair is a high crime and misdemeanor. They could impeach him based on that because there's no rule saying they can't. The Senate could convict him and remove him from office on the article of impeachment that says it's a high crime and misdemeanor to have that hair. You could imagine that a president would then go to the Supreme Court and say, we know that it is solely the right of the House and the Senate to impeach the president based on these, but they have not even come close to meeting the standard of a high crime and misdemeanor, and they have not fulfilled the Constitution. Now, I'm not hearing anybody saying that the president should be impeached for his hair. But I am hearing people say he should be impeached for obstruction of justice or conspiracy, whatever some of the things that maybe the special counsel investigation brings more data up on. Where between those two is actually an impeachable offense, that becomes the political side. That becomes the calculation of, do the American people who voted us into the House of Representatives and the Senate think of this as a high crime and misdemeanor? And do we have the political momentum to actually follow this through?
Yeah. And I want to ask you about the special counsel investigation, because I recall that you used to give daily intelligence briefings to then FBI Director Robert Mueller. Based on your impressions, what kind of a man is he?
He is somebody who, and I had the opportunity and the honor to brief many senior policymakers when I was at CIA, but he's one I got to know pretty well, because I would see him every working morning for more than a year to deliver his copy of the president's daily brief and other intelligence materials. And of all the wonderful public servants that I had the chance to brief and hopefully help inform with intelligence, he's at the top of the list in terms of somebody who could process both the strategic implications of the intelligence and dig down on the tactical part of the intelligence, often in the same sentence. I would brief him on some very complicated stories, often having to do with terrorism overseas. And he could both immediately drill down and ask questions that related to that particular case, and then sometimes in the same breath, tie that in to a larger story that we had briefed maybe weeks earlier. Being able to operate at both levels like that certainly serves him well in this investigation, which is one of the most complex investigations in American history. I also noticed that he had many opportunities to, for lack of a better word, showboat or to pat himself and the FBI on the back. I briefed a lot of things in those briefings where the FBI looked really good. And this was at a time when the FBI was under fire. There was talk of splitting the FBI into different organizations. Bob Mueller was opposed to that. He could have easily gone in front of the cameras or armed sources in the media with some of these stories from these intelligence briefings. And I never saw him do that once.
So he doesn't strike you as the kind of guy who might manufacture an investigation or have a political axe to grind, huh?
I've never saw him project his wishes, his opinions onto the intelligence. He used intelligence the way that, frankly, most policymakers do, but it's the ideal way, which is you get the facts, you look at what they say, you look at what they don't say, you look at the confidence levels of the intelligence assessments, and they help inform the decision that you make. You don't make your decision first and project it onto the facts. The other side of that is Bob Mueller has not been out in the public for the last year and a half refuting things that the president and others are saying to challenge the special counsel investigation. He has run the tightest shop in Washington, which really is a miracle.
Yeah, he's played things very close to the vest, despite the opaqueness as someone who got to know him. What do you think is going through his mind these days?
I think with all of the news that comes out, virtually every day it seems, there's something that comes up that is either unprecedented or rare in the history of the way that presidents interact with the rest of the executive branch, with the rest of the government, with the press, and with the people. I have no doubt that Bob Mueller is aware of that. I have no doubt that he raises his head to see the headline or to hear somebody walk in his office and say, "Did you hear what happened today?" And I'm just as confident that before that person stops their sentence, his head is back down doing his job. He has to be aware of some of that because it could relate. There are some public things that have come out that relate, for example, to possible obstruction of justice charges. But he's got a massive investigation going on with all kinds of inputs, ranging from financial information to intelligence reporting to tax returns. He's processing all of that, and he's not the kind of guy who's going to get distracted by a flashy headline.
Well, before we go, from where you stand, if you were a betting man, do you see President Trump finishing out the next 6 years? And if not, how do you think he might go?
If I had to put money on it, I would say it's probably close to 50-50.
Really?
That is, all of these methods of removing a president that I wrote about, almost all of them are possible, even if some are abhorrent and we don't want to see them happen in our system because that's not who we are. But there are many ways of removing a president. It could be that he pulls a Nixon and sees the writing on the wall if an impeachment charge is coming because of some strong evidence of obstruction of justice and criminal conspiracy. He could resign. He could just take the ball and go home. But that would be driven by impeachment in the same way that Nixon, in reality, was removed by impeachment. He just didn't let the process go through. But it's interesting. Nixon resigned because he saw the impeachment writing on the wall. But Richard Nixon, even as he was abusing power, he still respected some of the U.S. government and system. He had served in the military. He had been vice president for 8 years. He'd been a prominent senator. This was somebody who, I believe, loved his country even as he was doing things that were undermining the institutions of the country. We don't know where Donald Trump is on that. A lot of his statements, a lot of his interactions show that he doesn't have that same, certainly not the same career of public service, but we don't really know if it comes down to it, will he seek to tear down the institutions rather than resigning and sparing the country that debacle?
Well, we'll see what happens. It was certainly an interesting read and education. Again, David Preece's book is called How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, and Unfit Chief Executives. David, thanks for talking with me.
Ben, it was a pleasure.
Thanks again to David Preece for coming back on the podcast. Order his new book, How to Get Rid of a President, History's Guide to Removing Unpopular, Unable, or Unfit Chief Executives on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. And you can keep up with David at lawfareblog.com/contributors/dpreece or on Twitter at David Preece. The Flatiron School will teach you everything you need to get a job in code, data science, or design. But they'll also prepare you for the jobs that don't even exist yet. Go to flatironschool.com/podcast and read about graduates' new careers, salary ranges, upcoming courses, and explore these exciting new careers. You can start building your own career in coding, data science, or digital design at one of Flatiron's local WeWork campuses, or you can take courses online. Go to flatironschool.com/podcast, read the reviews, and sign up for a free intro course. Enrollment is open now. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.